time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for tuning in. I was going to say it's a beautiful day out there, but, you know, it's Friday, so let's settle for that. A little light rain out there, but otherwise a nice day. Don't even need the winter coat. Gotta love that. All right, coming up on the program today, we got a full lineup for you. Coming up in our second hour this morning, Senate Majority Leader Joe Benning will be joining us. Also, Governor Shumlin joins us coming up at about 10:10. And later this hour, the Speaker of the House, Shap Smith, will be joining us. That'll be coming up at about 9:35, 9:40-ish. Your phone calls, welcome on the program. You can join us at the usual phone numbers. And don't think because we're here at the legislature that it makes any difference for you. You can just pick up your phone and call us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. We're going to begin this morning and talk a little bit about water quality. And joining us right now here, let's give a nice home radio Vermont welcome this morning to Dave Mears, who's the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Thank you for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on.
The Senate Natural Resources Committee voted out the big lake bill, as it's being called. And I want to get some of your thoughts on what this might do. Let's look a little bit down the road in terms of the cleanup of the lake and the other waterways. Let me get some information here first for me. So when is the EPA supposed to be evaluating the plan that the state has put forward, and when are you going to hear from them?
They are evaluating it right now. We submitted to them last year, and they've been in the process of evaluating with their models and their scientists whether it's going to get the job done. And they've indicated that they're waiting till the end of this session to make a final decision. They wanted to know if we had sufficient authority and capacity to be able to implement the plan that we put forward.
Okay.
So I hope to see a result this summer, June or July.
What does that mean, sufficient capacity? What is
that? We have the resources to do it, that, you know, we have, you know, we've committed to put in place certain regulatory programs like a new town highways program and to expand some of our stormwater programs for the Agency of Agriculture to increase the stringency of the requirements for farmers. And in order for that to be real, we actually have to have the staff to implement those. So part of it's the staff within our agencies. Part of it is making sure that we have sufficient tools to work with our municipalities and other partners like the University of Vermont Extension, Agricultural Extension, or other partners to make sure they have the resources necessary. Regional planning commissions would be another example.
Mm-hmm. The way I understand this, the current draft, though, that's been put forward would not hit these target phosphorus reductions in a couple of key areas of the lake. How would the EPA possibly approve this unless those areas are going to be below the levels that they need to be?
Well, the question is not so much about whether we're going to achieve those targets. We know that we have to, and EPA cannot approve a plan unless we know that we're going to get there. The question at this point is timing. How much time will it take, and what's an acceptable amount of time? We've indicated we think we can get most of the way, if not all the way there, within 20 years, which is the time frame EPA's pressed us to get to. But it may be that we have to do additional work, and we've actually been, particularly in the Missisquoi area where agriculture is such a major source, been in pretty intensive discussions about how we might enhance and increase the level of oversight we provide for agriculture in that area.
Okay, so I'm not understanding this. So you submitted the plan, but it was not going to hit those target reductions, and you're now having discussions about it?
Correct. We issued a plan. It was almost exactly a year ago that we put our plan out. It was in May of 2014. And since that time, EPA has let us know that it doesn't quite meet the targets. So we had to go back to the drawing board, and so we've been working with the Agency of Agriculture to figure out how we enhance the practices that would be required for farms in those areas.
Okay. So let's say this bill passes and it goes into effect on July 1. What happens on July 1?
Well, the
pollution just starts to go away, right?
Right. I wish it were that simple. No, I mean, the issues are, well, just to remind ourselves, the kinds of things that we're trying to get after are the polluted stormwater runoff that comes off of our parking lots, our roofs, our yards, our roads, our farm fields, as the primary sources that we're trying to get at. We already have some existing programs that kind of hold the baseline, but we've been losing ground. So we've got to turn the corner on that, and that means looking at some things we haven't looked at very hard before. So some of the things that you should already be seeing as you drive around the Vermont landscape that will be increasing in the next couple of years will be a more kind of practices on the sides of roads. You should see more stone-lined ditches, better road practices, less of the kinds of activities where people just kind of gouge out the ditch so that there's all sorts of erosion. Start to see more rain gardens, start to see more parking lots that have features where instead of shunting all the rainwater off into storm drains, it's going to be collected and gathered in vegetated swales, and, you know, sediment ponds and those kinds of things. So those are the kinds of activities that people see on the ground.
Okay, what about writing regulations? How long is that going to take?
Well, some of the regulations are in works already. We've started the hard work of kind of developing things. For instance, we're enhancing the stormwater guidance manual. It's a document that kind of sets out the basic kinds of technologies and standards that people have to meet when they build stormwater infrastructure. So we hope to have that done within 2015. There's other pieces that may take into early 2016, but we're running full guns already.
Was there enough that's been done in this bill to deal with runoff from development, runoff from parking lots?
This bill does one important thing with regard to development of, you know, that kind of developed land stormwater, which is that it requires us to look at that kind of existing development, that's large development outside of developed areas like, say, of City of Burlington or South Burlington. So like a large box store that may be on the edge of town that's not covered by the stormwater requirements that the town has to meet, it requires the state to step in and address those kinds of developments, which I think is a good thing for two reasons. One is it would be unfair if the only stormwater requirements only applied in urban areas, because frankly, we don't want to create more disincentives for people to develop in downtowns and village centers. That's where we want development to happen. And that's not the only place where stormwater causes problems. So the bill will drive us to look at the larger developments outside of urban areas.
One of the issues that came up in the Senate Natural Resources this week, the authority, my understanding, that they really have is over forestry. And there did not seem to be much that is being done from forestry on this issue. Is that fair to say?
Well, it was a concern that one senator that voted against it, Senator Mark McDonald, voted against the bill. And one of his main concerns was he felt like it didn't do enough in the area of forestry. But the bill does, in fact, require the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation to update what are called the accepted management practices, the set of rules and requirements that apply to forest roads and logging practices. And so it does address that. It is fair to say, though, however, it's not nearly as extensive in terms of dealing with forest issues as it is with agriculture or development and stormwater. But there's a reason for that, which is that it's not the biggest problem. One of our key priorities in this bill and in our overall clean water efforts across the state, not just for Lake Champlain, is to make sure we focus our efforts where the biggest problems are. And our forests, in all honesty, are one of our greatest assets when you start talking about clean water. The forests absorb and manage rainfall in a way that most of our developed surfaces do not.
Let's talk a little bit about agriculture. Are you satisfied with the level at which farms are going to be changing their practices?
I am very excited. I was at a meeting last week with a group of the kinds of partners, the age governmental and local partners that are working on agricultural issues. This particular group was down in the Hartford area, White River Junction, but we've been having similar meetings across the state. And there is an energy right now among all of the partners who are working on agricultural issues, because they're starting to see a cultural change among the farm community. For the longest time, there's been, as you know, a very strong resistance to kind of any new additional changes in the way that farms manage their nutrients or their farm fields or practices. What's happening is farmers are beginning to see that it's economically beneficial to them to do a better job of managing their soils and their nutrients. So that's coming together at the same time that we have no choice but to increase the level of regulatory oversight. So I think those two things are coming together in a very positive way.
But at the end of the day, the practices that farmers have to continue to do are going to be voluntary, correct?
No, not at all. There's a set of baseline practices that all farms will have to meet. They currently are required to meet these on the large and medium-sized farms. And we're doing two things. One, we're enhancing those or increasing the stringency of those. There's things like the amount of buffer width, the vegetation between a farm field and a stream. We're increasing that to be consistent across all farms. We're requiring things like fencing livestock out of streams, something that seems pretty obvious and common sense, but it hasn't been required. We're making that a requirement for farms to meet. That's one piece of it. And then the other piece is we haven't had the resources to really do the outreach and oversight of a whole swath of farms that are kind of in the category of small farms that have frankly had very little attention or oversight. So that's a place where we're intending to get at. You know, if you just look just at dairy, putting aside vegetable farms or other kinds of livestock, there's half of the dairy cows in the state are on farms that are 200 cows or less. We haven't paid any attention to them. That's a significant source of pollution, and this bill requires the Agency of Agriculture to start doing that work.
We're talking with the Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Dave Mears. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Correct me if I misunderstood this, but when this bill originally came out, there was discussion about taxing fertilizer for the agriculture community, not just commercial fertilizer for somebody, a homeowner like you or me.
That's correct.
Is that a significant change in your view?
I do think it's significant. It's the offset of that, though, is that it was replaced by the House and ultimately confirmed by the Senate Natural Resources Committee with a set of fees, regulatory fees on farms. So it's not like the farmers are getting off scot-free in terms of the cost of implementing these programs. It was just a shift from a fertilizer tax to a regulatory fee that's based on the permitting function that the Agency of Agriculture serves.
Wouldn't it have made a lot more sense, though, to keep that fee on the fertilizer? Isn't part of the idea here to try to drive down the use of it?
Well, we thought so. It was our proposal that, you know, it was Governor Shumlin's and his budget proposal included the fertilizer tax. We thought it made sense. It's a direct relationship to the one of the significant causes of pollution in the state. But in the course of their discussions, the legislature found that they felt that the regulatory fees were a fairer approach to it. Don't have a strong disagreement with that. At some level, it's, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other.
So those kinds of changes, and I understand your point that forestry is not a big contributor, but still there doesn't seem to be much participation that they're doing. I know there's a lot of questions about, you know, is there being enough being done in terms of development? So, you know, I guess I'm wondering at the end of this process, you know, this whole phrase, I haven't heard this phrase all in lately from public officials. Is everybody really all in here?
I believe so. This is one of the most comprehensive efforts that I've ever been part of in my career working on clean water issues. And what's exciting to me is that rather than continuing to fight over an increasingly small, you know, proportion of the overall pollution, we're looking at things that professionals that have been in this field knew 30 years ago that we needed to be dealing with stormwater runoff from farms and from developed areas and from roads. We just haven't done it. And we've relied on voluntary programs and education and outreach. And in some places and spots, that's produced real results. But we haven't had a real comprehensive strategy to address that. This is the first time we've really done it. Is it perfect? No. I think there's obviously gaps. And, the political process leads to all sorts of kind of, the sausage-making process isn't pretty. So I anticipate that we'll come through this and we'll evaluate and find that there were gaps or ways that we can fix things. But in terms of the overall thrust of this legislation and of our overall clean water initiative, I'm as excited as I've ever been about our efforts.
So you think that this will legitimately result in cleanup of the lake and it's not just a fly under the radar to get by the EPA here?
Absolutely not. I have real strong hopes for this. That is not to say that we're on a glide path to success, even if this bill passes. We still have some substantial work to do. These regulatory programs could get held up in court challenges. The regulated community may fight back. The municipalities are still feeling swamped in terms of the overall cost of these programs, and we haven't quite figured out the mechanism by which municipalities will be able to pay for this work. So we still have some uphill battles to go through.
Let's talk just sort of science here for a moment. You talk about this idea of wanting to stop the problem from getting worse. And you talk about a 20-year timeline in terms of getting these reductions to the level that the EPA is looking at. At what point here, Dave, does the amount of pollution going in stabilize?
We're actually pretty close to a point where the pollution is stabilizing, according to our scientists. It, when you look at the charts, you see this inexorable and gradual increase in the amount of phosphorus in the lake, and it causes you to question whether or not the things we've been doing are working. But when you dig a little deeper into it, you realize that part of the reason that those levels have continued to increase is that we've been fighting against an increasing amount of precipitation and rainfall and snow runoff. And the amount of phosphorus is directly connected to that. So if you took out the amount of rainfall and flows and kept it steady. We actually have been reducing phosphorus levels, or at least holding them steady. What that tells us is that what we're doing is headed in the right direction. We just have to do more of it. So that's the, I think we're on the verge of stabilizing and turning the corner to really begin to decrease the inputs.
Do you think that the cleanup would happen faster if the the regulation and enforcement of bad agricultural practices were put back into the hands of ANR?
I don't. I've been around long enough. I'll just give an example. When I was in the state of Texas, I saw the clean water program shift between the Environmental Regulatory Agency and the Agency of Agriculture. And all it really did was keep everybody discombobulated. Nobody knew where their desk was or where the pencils were. The program is solidly ensconced at the Agency of Agriculture. There's some pros and cons to that. One of the pros is that they have a lot of good relationships with the farmers. And for those farmers who just need technical assistance and help, and want someone that they can trust to talk to, it's exactly the right group of people to be having those conversations. It's harder, I think, for the Agency of Agriculture than to turn the corner and take the enforcement actions, but they have done it. They have been doing it, and they're building a culture of a willingness to do that. And we can enhance that, and we are in the process of trying to build a stronger relationship and use more of my agency's resources to help on enforcement. And the Attorney General's office is a big part of that as well. So I think the better approach is, rather than kind of pick the program up and shift it between agencies, is just to make the existing program work better and to address the challenges head on.
Okay, but it used to be that this was exclusively the purview of ANR. And, you know, back in 92, this was the deal. So, you know, how can you say that this has been a better way to go?
Well, I can say that at the time in 92, the Agency of Natural Resources wasn't doing a particularly good job of dealing with agricultural pollution either. The issue with farm pollution has, there's been two big problems. One is very practical and real, and the other is political. The very practical challenge is that farms don't lend themselves to kind of one technology, one kind of practice that works for all farms. They have very different slopes, styles, you know, some of what works for a livestock. A beef farm may not work for a sheep farm or a dairy farm. And what works in, you know, Addison County doesn't necessarily work down in Windsor County. So you have to have very detailed farm-specific kinds of solutions. It's very intensive work. That's the practical set of problems. The political problem is that the farm community has historically, in Vermont and nationally, been very opposed to any kind of oversight and regulation, and they've been successful in fending that off. We've turned the corner on both of those. We have a much better, more sophisticated sense of how to put good farm practices in place. And as is witnessed by this bill moving through, which is a very strong bill in terms of the agricultural components, it's moving through without any strong opposition from the farm community. Frankly, it's moving in part because the farm leadership support it.
Strong, there's no strong opposition from the farm community. They were pretty adamant about wanting to get out the current use penalties, getting rid of that tax on commercial fertilizer. I would say they've done pretty darn well.
They have certainly opposed components of it, and I don't want to overstate it. But in terms of their commitment to moving a bill that includes clean water provisions, they're in it. And there's even taking those more controversial issues out of play, there's a lot in this bill that to like in terms of addressing agricultural pollution.
Okay, help me. Give me some evidence and a strong the indication that there's been a change at the department, at the Agency of Agriculture, and building this willingness for enforcement. Where's the evidence that things have changed?
If you look back, I don't have right at my fingertips the number of cases that have been brought in the last couple of years, and you'll start to see that the numbers of cases, the amounts of penalties, the number of referrals to the Attorney General's office, and the number of referrals to my department has gone up. We have a significant number of cases. There's not a month that goes by right now where we aren't bringing some kind of a case against someone for a leaking manure lagoon, or there was a guy a few months ago who was caught, you know, rinsing his manure trucks out and discharging them into streams. You know, we're taking those cases, and we're not having to pull them out of the Agency of Agriculture. Their inspectors are finding them and bringing them to the AG's office and to our office.
What difference will it make, the added personnel? Tell me the impact that's going to have.
The biggest single effect is the presence that we can have on the smaller farms. Those are the biggest challenge for us. At some level, you know, while we like to, you know, throw sticks and stones at the large farms, they actually have because of the capacity they have to hire consultants and the economics of it, they've in some ways are ahead of most of the smaller farms. And by small farms, I'm not talking like two cows. You know, small farms are defined at anything less than 200 cows for dairy farms. So there's some pretty large operations out there. And, anyone who's driven around the Vermont landscape knows that there can be a pretty big mess associated with those farms. We need to get folks out on those farms, talking to those farmers, making sure they understand the rules, giving them guidance and help, helping them look for funding sources to get at the problems. And if they don't turn their operation around, being prepared to bring enforcement. Those are all resource of intensive activities. And, the Agency of Agriculture needs more resources to do that. And they, frankly, can also leverage, those staff also leverage then more resources from the federal government and from local community groups and conservation districts.
Okay, let's talk about how this is all going to get paid for. A couple of different proposals out there. The administration had an idea. The House changed it to basically one of the key components being a property transfer tax surcharge. The Senate Natural Resources Committee changed it, the Senate is going to be changing it, a $25 per parcel fee. So what are your thoughts on the evolution of the funding source?
Well, at some level, as not an elected official, I would like to kind of just ignore some of the broader political dynamics around all that.
Good luck.
So I know I can't avoid it, but just for a moment, if I allow me to live in my fantasy world, what I really need as an administrator of these programs is steady, consistent, reliable funding. When you're talking about a 20-year plan, we have to have something that we can build a foundation on, and that the staff and the programs and the external partners, like regional planning commissions or municipalities, know that they can rely that there will be a consistent, steady investment. And the opportunity to dial that investment up or down, in a rational way, depending on the problems. So that's what I'm looking for as a practical matter. And so one of the reasons I liked what the House did was that it took an existing program, the property transfer tax, that doesn't require a lot of immediate investment. It can be dialed up a little bit. It generates some significant investment, and it buys us some time to put in place a more complicated system. What I'd really, in my dreams, we're just not ready to do it. I'd like to have a system of revenue raising that's tied directly to the sources of pollution. And in the case of stormwater, it's the land uses. So having something that's tied to the amount of pavement and parking lots and production areas on farms would be the most rational way to kind of develop this. We don't yet have the data and the systems at the Department of Taxes to put that in place. So having the property transfer tax as a near-term, kind of interim source of funding would give us the time to build to that. So I've liked that. It seems an elegant solution. We also continue to feel like our original proposal of having kind of a more a rougher hewn version of an impervious cover tax or fee, where it's tied to industrial and commercial uses of the land, also is a good interim solution, although neither chamber seems to like our proposal.
This idea, though, of a $25 fee per parcel, one of the criticisms I've heard about it is that you would pay $25 at your house and Walmart would pay $25 up in Williston.
I think it's a fair criticism of it. It's not the most fair or equitable, way to raise the funding. It does have the benefit of, I acknowledge that the senators who have developed this have done a very careful job of trying to think through some of the logistical challenges. And it appears that there are ways that, this could be collected in a relatively near term and would be a stable source of funding. But it does, as you note, have the issue of being somewhat unfair in terms of the parcel size. And it's not clearly as clearly tied as our proposal was to the, because we proposed something that was tiered based on the kind of number of acres of industrial or commercial development. So it does have that challenge.
When I went back and was looking this week at this 92 agreement, this memorandum of understanding that was supposed to be the big solution back then to deal with this agricultural pollution, there's a lot of, really beautiful language in there, some really lofty goals, and here we are where we are today. And I guess my question is, why should anybody be confident that this isn't going to be a political solution solved as opposed to an environmental problem solved?
Well, part of what gives me that assurance, this may or not work for others, is that we're building in accountability measures in a couple of different ways. One is in our own plan, we're building in timelines and milestones with deliverables, meaning like we have to produce a certain amount of results. This many of acres of fields have to be changed in the practices. We're changing numeric standards as they relate to the amount of soil conservation that has to happen. These are measurable, quantifiable things. And we're also looking, putting in place tracking mechanisms to require kind of transparency and accountability. So we have to report to the public and to the General Assembly every year under our initiative. And on top of that, we have EPA looking over our shoulder. And they are doing with Vermont what they did down in the Chesapeake Bay, where they're not allowing states to kind of make a set of promises and then going home. They're saying they're going to be coming back every year or 2 years and looking at whether we've delivered on our promises. So I think those accountability mechanisms are a big part of what give me confidence that even if I left tomorrow, that this is on a trajectory to success.
That's not happening.
I'm not planning to leave, no.
Let's go back here, though. I'm a little unclear where I began with you talking about these sort of, I would call the hot spots, the really polluted zones. So is there ongoing discussions about what to do with those areas? Because the way it's portrayed in stories in the paper is that the plan you submitted is insufficient. And I just don't understand how they approve a plan that's deficient.
Yeah, they can't. They won't approve the plan that we submitted last year. So we're in the process of updating it to talk about additional requirements that we'll obligate ourselves as a state to do. And a big part of that is looking at the areas in Missisquoi Bay, like up in Franklin County, and then down in the South Lake and some parts of Addison County, where agriculture is the biggest component of the pollution, and talking about what additional practices on top of fencing livestock out, on top of the basic kind of management requirements, are we going to go through and at those some farms and say, you know what, you just can't, you're going to have to take this land out of corn production. It's just too unstable. The soils are too erosive. You're going to have to put this into grass or pasture. Over here, you're going to have to extend your buffers further. That's going to be done on a farm-by-farm basis based on kind of the nature and circumstances of that farm. But that's the kind of structure that we're putting in place. And it won't be something that goes into effect right away. We're going to have to give extra time and resources to those farms to help them figure that out. But that's the set of commitments we're working towards putting in place.
Okay, so EPA is looking for a commitment, right? Is that the right word?
Yes, they want it to be an enforceable commitment. So, you know, EPA is a more of a regulatory agency, and they are most comfortable when we have regulations in place. So they're looking in part to the regulatory programs we put in place. Do our regulations have clear standards? Do we have the staff in place to enforce them? But they're also giving us credit for additional things where we have identified planning or outreach or educational programs. And it's a mix of all those things are part of what we're committing to do. And ultimately what they'll be measuring us against is the results. Have we actually produced changes in farm practices that are reducing pollution? And that's ultimately our shared goal.
So in some of these hot spots, you're going to be putting into place mandatory practices.
Across all farms, we'll be putting in place mandatory practices. And then in some farms, we'll be going above and beyond that and requiring even further and enhanced practices.
Your biggest fear about this bill going forward would be what?
My biggest fear is that the general trends, the economic trends and development trends in the state are working against us. You know, local governments are frequently making decisions to allow development in places that, you know, reduce our wetlands, you know, cover up our floodplains, add impervious surfaces without adding additional, you know, ways to collect and slow it down. And so a lot of the development patterns we've seen in the state where you start to see condominium complexes and strip malls popping up are working in the wrong direction. And the other fear I have is also an economic one, is that the way the farm economy works and the prices of corn have been driving more and more farmers to put more and more land into corn. And that's just a challenging dynamic in terms of reducing pollution. So at the same time that we're working to control these sources of pollution, we have to really pay attention to the future decisions we make to make sure they're not headed in the wrong direction.
But the problem, I would imagine, is there's no authority on the state level to start to get involved with municipal or town developments.
There really isn't. We rely very heavily on working with local governments and regional planning commissions to help them identify ways that they can protect against those kinds of decisions. And the ironic thing is that it's not like anyone steps back and plans out their community to look like the subdivisions around Boston. It just happens in incremental decisions. So what we're trying to do, the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, regional planning commissions, our agency are trying to work with communities to help create incentives to build in village centers and downtowns, places where we already have development, and to increase the disincentives to develop outside of those areas. So there's only so far we can go as a state, but we're continuing to develop new strategies for that. I expect that we may have more proposals to come in the future months.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Dave Mears is the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. We'll take a short break. Coming up next, we'll talk with Speaker Shep Smith. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Yvonne from VSECU, a credit union for everybody in Vermont. Recently, I overheard a group of people talking about ways to improve banking in Vermont. They said they wish that banks could operate like a food co-op, where the customers are owners and members share in the profits. What they didn't know is that their wish already exists. It's us, VSECU. We are a member-owned financial co-op that just happens to offer banking and financial products and services. Like other cooperatives, we're also not-for-profit. Profits go back to our member owners in the form of higher saving rates, lower rates on loans, and access to affordable services. The number one reason why you should think outside of the bank is ownership. If you live or work in Vermont and join VSECU, you automatically become an owner of your financial institution. Learn more at vsecu.com.
This credit union is federally insured by NCUA.
Join WDEV this weekend, April 18th and 19th, for the 46th annual Vermont Home and Garden Show at the Champlain Valley Expo in Essex Junction. Come to the show for all of your building, remodeling, landscaping, gardening, and lifestyle needs. And while you're there, stop by the Radio Vermont table for great giveaways from Fresh Tracks Farm in Montpelier and sign up to win terrific prizes from the Round Barn in Waitsfield. The Vermont Home and Garden Show, Saturday and Sunday, April 18th and 19th, presented by the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of Northern Vermont.
Are you a flavor junkie? Do you have discerning taste or just really opinionated taste buds? Well, if so, and you're 18 or older, the Keurig Green Mountain Sensory Test Center wants to hear from you. Join us at our facility in Waterbury Center for ongoing tasting sessions. And be the first to experience innovative foods, beverages, and other products before you see them in the grocery aisle. Tasting sessions happen every week and only take 30 to 45 minutes. Each time you visit, you'll receive rewards such as Amazon gift cards and Keurig.com discounts, plus incentives to shop and eat locally while you're in town. Who doesn't want the opportunity to have fun and get rewarded at the same time? All you have to do is tell us what you think. There's no experience necessary to participate. You just need to be 18 or older and love trying new things. Become a Keurig Green Mountain taste tester today and let your voice be heard. Give us a call at 882-2500 and don't forget to tell your friends.
April is one of the best times of the year to drive a new Nissan. Jack Castellaneta, it seems like everyone has some kind of sale, but even their sale prices don't beat a Formula Nissan deal.
If you've ever wondered why so many people are driving cars and trucks from Formula Nissan, come find out in April. Our simple, straightforward, factory direct pricing means you get more car for less money, period.
You're taking up to $5,500 right off the MSRP of select new Nissans, or get 0% financing for up to 72 months on five popular Nissan models.
Check the newspapers. Check the internet. You won't find a better deal anywhere. And our selection compares with some of the largest dealers in New England.
Straightforward, factory direct pricing, all the selection you need, and exclusive Formula Nissan discounts. It all adds up to April being the best time of the year to drive a new Nissan for less.
We're on the Barry Montpelier Road next to Pizza Hut and at FormulaNissan.com. Let us show you how easy it is to do business here.
Kids love mud, so take yours to the 10th annual Echo Earth Week Mudfest at Echo Leahy Center for Lake Champlain. A 16-day celebration of Earth Day and mud season, now through Sunday, April 26th, featuring muddy activities, including the popular mud fling and mud table. The family will love checking out cool tractors and planting seeds, trying muddy food from Sugar Snap Cafe, and catching some great spring music. New this year, a special visit from Animal Encounters with your favorite spring critters on April 25th. Bring all the kids you know to Echo on the Burlington waterfront now through Sunday, April 26th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. daily. Mudfest will be the most fun your family has ever had with mud. So don't miss a muddy minute. Visit echovermont.org for more information. Mudfest is sponsored by 101, The One, WDEV, News Channel 5, Gardner Supply, High Mowing Seeds and Harvest Equipment. Gosh, I love mud.
Back at the State House in Montpelier, we're going to be joined now. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to the Speaker of the House, Shep Smith. Mr. Speaker, thank you for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm good.
I want to begin. Yesterday, the Auditor of Accounts, Doug Hoffer, released a report on the Vermont Health Connect, the state's medical insurance website. How would you characterize it?
I think that it highlighted a number of things that we already knew, but put them in perspective and really help explain why we do not have a system that works correctly now. I think, one, it's a good dissection of what has happened, but I think it could serve as a roadmap for what to do and what not to do in the future on IT projects.
Okay. Tell me more what you mean by that.
Well, I think that it identifies some of the areas where we made some pretty critical mistakes in designing the system and in the way that we contracted with our vendors that should serve as guidance for us in the future on how we need to do system design and how we need to more carefully vet the contractors that we're going to hire.
I suspect that the governor will say later in the program that a lot of these problems are old, they've already been known, that there's really not an awful lot new in this report. Would you agree with that characterization?
I think that it's probably fair to say that most of the things were already known. But I think the fact that this is all in one place and creates a narrative that really helps people see in a chronological order and in a holistically what went wrong, I think that it is more helpful than what we've seen in the past.
You've expressed some concerns about the healthcare exchange and talked about the possibility of moving to another system. Did this report make you more confident or less confident about the success of the current Vermont Health Exchange?
It caused some real concerns for me about whether we're going to be able to meet the May 31st deadline, which was set out by the administration. And, it calls into question for me whether the design of the system and the implementation date on May 31st is one that's achievable. Look, the reality is that many Vermonters have already lost confidence in the exchange. And I think that if we don't meet another deadline, it's going to be almost impossible to get any confidence back at all.
This May 30th deadline, the end of May deadline that the governor laid out a couple of weeks ago, also included an October deadline. And it seems as though really the May deadline is kind of bogus and a little bit soft, because if the May deadline isn't met, then there's this October deadline.
Well, if we don't actually meet the May 31st deadline, I just don't see how we can go back to Vermonters and suggest that they should continue to have confidence in us that we can make the system work. And so I think that at that point in time, we have to basically reassess where we're going. And my strong belief is that we need to explore other options.
Okay. And when you say we, who would that we be? Legislature?
I mean, it's the legislature has to appropriate all the money for this. The legislature appropriates. The executive branch has to execute on it. My view is that the legislature and the administration are going to have to explore different options. Now, my hope is that we'll be on the same page, and I think we will be. I think that the governor is as frustrated as anybody else is, as are members of his team. We may not have to worry about this, because my hope is that in May 31st, Optum will have done the work that it needs to do, and the change of circumstances will work. So right now it's speculative, and my hope is that we get to the place that we need to get to.
It may be speculative, but it's pretty soon, and you've got a plan for it anyway. If the legislature's not in session, are you prepared to call people back?
I don't actually have the power to call people back. The governor does. I think that
you can ask.
I can ask, and I think that we ought to be in a place where we have structure set out that we can move in a different direction.
Okay.
Whether it needs to have the legislature come back or whether there's some other structure to do that, I think is a matter for discussion.
Okay. Can you give me just an idea what that might look like? How would you do it other than bring the legislature back?
Well, I mean, I think that we could put in place a process through sort of the Health Oversight Committee, the Joint Fiscal Committee, perhaps the Emergency Board, where we could set something up so that we can make decisions or have decision points to move to a different exchange.
There's a company, one of the findings that the auditor had, this company that's making $40,000 a month, in his view, without performing any duty. Is there anything that the legislature can do? Can you get into this contract in any way or not?
I haven't had a chance to look through the entire report, so I don't know the specifics around that, but I would expect us to take a pretty serious look at allegations that there was a company that got paid for no work.
So at the end of May, you're going to be looking at the function. What specifically has to work for, in your view?
Well, we've been told that by the end of May, the change of circumstances functionality on the website will work. My hope is we're not going to have any discussion about moving to another exchange because the contractor will have done what it's been contracted to do. But if we haven't met that functionality, which is a working change of circumstances, then I think we need to explore other options.
Is the auditor correct in this, that it takes a year? If you want to go on the federal exchange, you need to notify them, and then there's a year process?
I don't think that there's any way that we would be able to move to a different exchange and have it work for us before calendar year or plan year 2017. So I think we're stuck with the current exchange for the next year and a half or so.
Wow.
I mean, that's my understanding. There may be different answers to that, but my understanding is that the timeline is that it would take us about till 2017 plan year to move over.
Okay. What's your feeling about that? Is that acceptable to you?
If that's the reality, is it acceptable to me? I think that the question is whether it's acceptable to Vermonters. I mean, Vermonters want to have an exchange that works, and we ought to be working towards that goal. And look, my hope is that we don't even have to have this conversation. If people do the jobs that they've been contracted to do, then hopefully everything will be functioning by May 31st, and we'll have something that Vermonters can use.
You might understand why people would be a little skeptical about that, though.
Yes, I know exactly why people are skeptical about it, yes.
So why do you have any confidence that in the next, we're talking an incredibly, 5 weeks here, everything's going to all of a sudden get better?
That's what people have been contracted to do, so I'm not going to prejudge them. We've got 5 weeks for them to finish their work, and hopefully it will work correctly.
Let's talk about this gun bill that's been going through the legislature. Why was this so controversial yesterday? Why was this so problematic in your view?
I don't really understand. I mean, the gun bill was addressing two specific issues. It was basically saying, if you have been convicted of a dangerous felony, you shouldn't be allowed to have a gun. And if you've been adjudicated as someone who is has the potential to harm yourself or others, you should not have a gun. Those seem like common sense ideas. With regard to the adjudication, mental health, danger to yourself or others, this bill also sets up a process by which you can restore your gun rights, something that doesn't exist under state law now. So I don't really understand the controversy around it. I think that any bill that deals with the issue of guns is going to be controversial because it's a constitutional right, not unlike free speech. I think that's why in the end it was somewhat controversial bill.
I was surprised to see that the penalty, if you're a convicted felon in these categories that you're trying to prevent from owning guns, that if you were caught with a gun, that it's a misdemeanor. Do you have any idea why it's not something more significant than a misdemeanor?
I think that was meant to, that was sort of a balance. It is a breach of the law. Whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, it's a breach of the law. And I think it was meant to set out the fact that it is.